The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think that they underestimated this largely white crowd. You know, people tend to think of white people as being more sympathetic towards the police, especially in contrast to the Black Lives Matter protests that had been happening, you know, sort of calling on our communities to sort of right size or even abolish police. So unfortunately, the Capitol Police mistakenly believed that these folks were their friends and allies. And I'm not the only one who feels that way. Even former MPD Chief Ramsey acknowledged it as well, saying, you know, there's really no other way to look at it other than this was a result of unconscious or implicit bias.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 5th, 2022. Although many individual police officers acted heroically on January 6th, the successful attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob seeking to disrupt the certification of the electoral votes is one of the biggest policing failures in American history. Not only did the Capitol Police fail to prepare for the attack, but many members of the mob were themselves police officers from around the country. Vita Johnson is an associate professor of law at Georgetown Law School, an author of a recent Law Review article and companion Lawfare post exploring the tactical and structural policing failures that contributed to January 6th. I spoke with her about what the police should have done differently and the role that race and politics play in how police react to domestic extremism. One note, this podcast was recorded on June 20th, before some of the recent revelations of the January 6th committee. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 5th, Vita Johnson on how the police contributed to the January 6th insurrection.
I'm curious, before we get into, you know, your piece on the police, I'm curious what you've made of these hearings thus far, either with respect to the issue you've been writing about, police involvement in January 6th, or just generally.
Well, I have to say I've been really impressed by the quality of the hearings. It's very clear that the people working on the hearings have really done their homework. There's been intensive research. The fact that they have been able to make so many of their points using the people involved, the Republicans who helped sort of orchestrate this big lie, has been really impressive to me. I mean, not to get too much into politics, I'd sort of given up hope on the Democrats a little bit. So to see this, you know, high level of competence was really satisfying. But I'm curious to see where it goes, how it's going to end. It all seems really illuminating. And there were plenty of things I didn't know going into the hearing. So it's really been fascinating.
Has it changed your views on the role of police, either the Capitol Police or police in general or law enforcement in general? Obviously, the first hearing, the kind of opening hearing, had some pretty powerful testimony from one of the Capitol Police officers. And I'm curious if that sort of changed your view.
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think that officer, I'm forgetting her name, she was, you know, obviously a very attractive, sympathetic view of what police engagement looked like on January 6th. And her account, I think, really illustrates some of the points that I make in my article, which is that the Capitol Police were unprepared, didn't have the right equipment to meet the level of violence that the police were greeted with on January 6th. But it doesn't, of course, show the side of, you know, the police complicity in the attacks. She had one description of there being so much blood that they were slipping in it. Obviously I wasn't there, but that struck me as potentially hyperbole on her part, or just, you know, a misremembering of a very traumatic event.
So let's get into your piece. So you've published a really great Law Review article in the Brooklyn Law Review about police and January 6th, and then you kind of adapted it into a Lawfare post. And I want to kind of walk through the main arguments you make in both of those pieces. So in your Lawfare piece in particular, you identify four ways in which law enforcement enabled, sometimes unintentionally, sometimes quite intentionally, the January 6th attack. And so I want to go through each of them and unpack them. The first factor that you mentioned is that the Capitol Police underestimated the crowd. They underestimated the crowd before in terms of the warnings that were pretty clear on kind of open source intelligence of people gathering. They underestimated the crowd when the crowd was there. So what did the Capitol Police know before the crowd forced itself into the Capitol? And maybe most importantly, what led to their failure to adequately prepare?
Okay, great. That's such an important question, probably the question that people in the Capitol Police are asking themselves or have been asking themselves. So first off, I want to dispel any myths about the quality of Capitol Police or their funding. They're an incredibly well-funded police department. They have over 2,000 officers to really protect us to a handful of buildings, if you think about it. Their police department is the size of the police department of San Diego, one of the top 10 largest cities in the country. So it's a really big police force. And they had warning signs, right? So there had been, you know, it feels both really recent and like ancient history, but, you know, in the months leading up to January 6th, there had been armed Trump supporting militia groups and individuals present at vote counting locations throughout the country. So there were news stories about what was taking place in Arizona and Michigan with the militia groups present while votes were being counted. There were two armed QAnon supporters arrested in Philadelphia, also going to be present during vote counting. We know that there were armed militia who were present during protests in major cities throughout the United States during the summer and fall of 2020, the protests about the killing of George Floyd. So there should have been a general understanding that far-right groups were getting dangerous, violent, and were armed. And that's against the backdrop of a lot of other things that were happening. So we know that there were groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers that were both participating in these sorts of protests, but also just sort of growing in strength and growing in popularity. Sometimes at the urging of Trump, there was his famous quip during a debate telling the Proud Boys to stand by, and that increased their membership. So the Capitol Police should have known that those sorts of far-right groups were dangerous and were related to what was going to happen on January 6th. But then they had specific threats from the NYPD and the FBI that there was going to be violence on January 6th. But despite those sort of general and specific warnings, it seems like the Capitol Police were pretty unprepared. They didn't have a full complement of staff. So it's somewhat common when there's going to be a big day to sort of, I think the term is recall people who have days off, but they didn't do that. They had insufficient staff. And probably the biggest problem in terms of, you know, police being prepared is they didn't have helmets or gas masks or riot gear. And so not only do you have sort of a paltry number of police on staff for what was going to take place, you know, over 10,000 people descending on the Capitol, they weren't dressed appropriately. And because of the tactics the crowd ended up using, those police officers were, ended up being involved in hand-to-hand combat when they could have had some other crowd control measures in place that they just didn't use, like aerosols and things like that. So they ended up in hand-to-hand, hours of hand-to-hand combat with an angry mob. And, you know, your big question is, why were they unprepared? And I think that it's largely because they underestimated this largely white crowd. You know, people tend to think of white people as being more sympathetic towards the police, especially in contrast to the Black Lives Matter protests that had been happening, you know, sort of calling on our communities to sort of right size or even abolish police. So I think, unfortunately, the police mistakenly believed that these folks were their friends and allies. And unfortunately, I'm not the only one who feels that way. Even MPD officer, former MPD chief Ramsey acknowledged it as well, saying, you know, there's really no other way to look at it other than this was a result of unconscious or implicit bias. So we know that's at least one way in which policing helped enable the Capitol siege on January 6th. But before I go too far, I want to also just acknowledge that the vast majority of people go into policing for all the right reasons, and that all Americans and probably all people suffer from implicit or unconscious biases. Even people of color have those biases against people of color. So this critique of law enforcement is really just one of failing to really assess accurately the situation in a way that they're supposed to assess the situation. It's not, in this instance, you know, I'm not saying there was anything willful involved in some of this underestimating this largely white crowd.
I want to dig in a little bit more into this question of perception of threat and its relation to the demographics of the crowd, and whether it's implicit or explicit, because a point you make, and I think this has been widely noticed, and I think this was quite notable just on January 6th. I remember thinking this myself, just the contrast between how the rioters on January 6th were treated relative to how a lot of the protests, the disturbances, some of which were riots. I mean, there were obviously a lot of things going on in the summer of 2020 with in connection to the Black Lives Matter protests and the George Floyd police killing. Now, I mean, obviously, it's a little difficult to compare because with the summer of 2020, there were a lot of things going on, right? You had a range of events from completely peaceful protests that went off without a hitch, in which some police marched with them, to, on the other hand, you know, protests that were treated quite brutally by police, to riots that needed to be, you know, dealt with in whatever way. With January 6th, you kind of have one event, and it's hard to kind of replay that. But I was hoping you could speak more about how you view that contrast, and also what you think should be done about it. Because there's always this difficult question, I think, when you see a disparity in law enforcement with respect to two populations. Do you ratchet down or do you ratchet up, right? Is the right answer that we should have treated everything in relation to, let's say, Black Lives Matter in the same relatively lenient way that the January 6th protests were treated? Or, to the extent that Black Lives Matter or some of those events needed to be treated with a certain degree of severity, that's the same severity that should have been treated, that the January 6th rioters should be treated with. It strikes me that that's kind of a difficult and a separate question than, is there a disparity?
Well, I think, number one, there absolutely was a disparity in the sort of policing response we saw to those two different events. But I think it's also important to note that we're talking about different police departments. So the Capitol Police largely was not involved in any of the Washington, D.C. protests in the summer and fall of 2020, as far as I know. That was mostly the Metropolitan Police Department, which is D.C.'s main police department, and some federal agencies that were different than Capitol Police. But I think the point is there, and to answer your big question about what should we do, I think, you know, police are supposed to be experts in community safety. And I think the police response that we saw in the summer and fall of 2020 was too big of a response to the threat posed by the Black Lives Matter movement, which was a generally a peaceful movement calling on there to be less violence, right? That was the whole point of those protests. But because it was a protest that was critical of police, police departments generally seem to sort of overreact to the threat of those large peaceful protest groups, as opposed to having specific intelligence about what was planned on January 6th and underreacting to that. And I think that's the big problem that many people have rightly pointed out about the police response to these two different sort of social movements that are that were going on, sort of at the same time, but also in reaction to one another.
Yeah, so you make an interesting point that I want to draw out, because I think there's a nuanced issue here, which is, what is the reason for the different treatment, right? Because we can say, well, one group of people is predominantly white, right? And therefore, that's what the police are reacting to, whereas another group of people are predominantly Black or people of color, that's what they're reacting to. Or one can say, well, it's not that, actually. What it is that one group of people is perceived as pro-police, right? And another group of people is perceived as anti-police. And obviously those two issues are not totally separable, but one might wonder which is the stronger kind of causal mechanism, right? Especially given that police, although they are maybe not as diverse as we'd like them to be, are hardly all white, especially in cities in which, you know, the majority of people are Black or of color. So I'm curious, do you think there's any way to untie, to separate the demographics and how those play on various implicit or explicit biases versus the question of this is a friendly quote unquote crowd versus this is an unfriendly crowd?
Well, I think this is such an important question, but I think it's important to step back for a second. Remember, the police are supposed to be public servants that are supposed to keep us all safe. So they should not have different responses because of the political messages of the groups that they're policing. But I think you're exactly right that it was a mix of both. One is that they understood that one group was calling to limit the power of police, while the other wasn't necessarily making a police-specific message. And then you have the issue of the Black Lives Matter protests of generally being more racially diverse. Though in many cities, in places like Portland, they were still largely white crowds, and you saw this intense police reaction, really over the top in many instances, and creating violence. I also like to think about what happened in the J20 protests back in 2017, where just as Donald Trump was being inaugurated, police in Washington, D.C., again, a different police department, really created a scenario where people were corralled into a small group and there was some property damage. But the police and prosecution response was really strong, and lots of people were prosecuted, none of them successfully. But it was a very intense sort of political reaction to the political message of the protesters by police. And so I do think that this sort of gets at the main point of my article, which is that we've got a problem in the culture of policing that would allow January 6th to happen. But also, if you look at the policing responses to some of these other political movements, it's troubling.
Yeah, I very much appreciate and take your point that police should not mistreat people who don't like police. That's not how this is supposed to work. At the same time, and maybe this is kind of an odd second best thinking that I'm engaging in, I'd rather the police not be racist and be very hypersensitive to criticisms of the police than the opposite. But I guess neither are ideal. But okay, if I had to choose, right? But I think this actually does nicely get into the second main factor that you talk about, the one that for me personally was the most disturbing, which was the presence of police officers, not necessarily Capitol police officers, but police officers from around the country in the January 6th riot. You know, we see a somewhat similar story with respect to active duty military, especially a lot of veterans. This strikes me as a very parallel story. And so I'd love to for you to just talk more about what we know about the involvement of active duty or, you know, of police officers in January 6th and what is going on in policing across this country.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. So we know that there were dozens of police officers who were present at both the rally preceding the breach of the Capitol and at the Capitol building itself. We know that two police officers have already been convicted for their role in what happened. They breached the Capitol. And what's going on in policing? That's the million-dollar question here. That's really what a lot of my research has focused on. But I think we've got two problems, both of which are very troubling. Either you have police who are so delusional that they actually believed that the election was stolen, or you have police who want to undermine democracy, right? Those are the two options. So if you're attending this rally, either you believe a conspiracy theory that the election was stolen, or you want to undo the election results, a fair election result, right? So that's a problem when you think about what we trust American police with. We trust them with weapons, access to really sensitive information. And if they want to undermine democracy, or if they can't separate fact from fiction, this is completely unacceptable. So both options are just very bad and scary in my mind. And I think it also highlights another issue in policing, which is that police are just too comfortable in their jobs. Like, can you imagine telling your boss, I'd like to take tomorrow off because I want to go follow a conspiracy theory, or I want to undo the election results? Like, both would, you know, raise serious question in your boss's mind. But yet that's what dozens of police officers and as you point out, military officials and military officers did on January 6th. And that's just too much job security in my mind. You know, it's a real, it goes to the strength of police unions that officers thought they could just take the day off of work and there'd be no repercussions.
I feel like this is where two law professors talking to each other should make a joke about tenure, but neither of us have tenure yet. So no riots for us, I think.
Yeah, not yet.
I do wonder more seriously though, if this issue of police involvement directly in January 6th relates a little bit to the previous conversation we were having about how the crowd was perceived. Because I do think one thing that's really struck me, and again, I agree, this is absolutely no excuse, right? Delusion at some point is not a, you know, a bar to moral or legal culpability. But a lot of these people really thought that they were standing up for the Constitution, they were standing up for the rule of law, you know, that the, I'm sure some of the police that were involved in January 6th thought that they were acting as police in the kind of truest, deepest sense of upholding law enforcement. And you know, I do wonder whether that maybe was part of why the Capitol Police reacted in such a kind of milquetoast way, because, well, there are lots of veterans and military people and police in the crowd. They must be on our side in some way. And it just turned out very much not to be the case.
There were reports by Capitol Police that there were members of the mob that were flashing their badges to gain entry into buildings. So I certainly think that was, in fact, something that was going on. And, you know, I don't know how widespread it was. I mean, we know that there are at least 40 police officers that were proven to be at the, or I don't know if proven, but have been documented as being either at the rally or at the Capitol that day. And God knows how many more there were. We know there were about 10,000 people. So it was a not insignificant amount. And it's from, I think, at least 13 states. So it's reason for concern for sure. And probably in my mind, one of the scarier ways to just imagine. And, you know, this isn't the only place that we've seen this sort of conspiracy thinking in policing, or the inability to separate fact from fiction. We saw that there's some evidence that there's QAnon supporters in American police forces, anti-mask COVID deniers on police. I mean, it really became a sort of common thing for police to not be wearing masks, even in 2020. And certainly at this point, you never see police officers wearing masks, even in places where they're required, like in subways and things like that. So there is certainly, I don't know, just a worry of mine that police are not adequately able to assess risk in lots of different areas, right? And are not good at, or some of them at least, are not good critical thinkers. And again, we're giving them so much power, right? We as a society give police access to sensitive information. We give them guns. We give them, they're the only people in our society apart from the military that have the ability to use lethal force. And if they're lacking in critical thinking skills, if they are falling for conspiracy theories, this is really scary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you. Constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout.
That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So you've described this as a kind of conspiratorial strain that runs through some American policing. And I guess I think I have two questions about that. One is, and maybe I'm sort of slicing the bologna too thin here, how much of this is conspiracy theory, right? Like weird QAnon, Pizzagate stuff versus just straight up white nationalism. Obviously they're related in some sense, but they're also distinct, right? You have, you know, plenty of people of color who believe in QAnon too. I mean, it's an interesting heterogeneous movement. So that's my first question. And then the second question is, how much of this is a problem of policing versus, well, police are just people. People are drawn from the population. The prevalence of these views in the population is X. And so, you know, the prevalence of these views within policing is also that. Or is there something like particularly problematic about what is happening in the culture of police over and above the issues that we are seeing in the public at large?
This is one of those things I think about all the time. So if you go back to Charlottesville, and just after Charlottesville in 2017, ABC did a poll, and they found that about 10% of Americans who were polled thought it was acceptable to hold neo-Nazi views. And just after the Capitol, I think it was Reuters, had a poll that found about 12% of Americans were sympathetic towards the plight of the rioters. Okay, so let's just assume those numbers are right. And so you've got about 10 to 12% of the population that has these sort of extremist views. Well, let's just guess that those polls are right. And then if you consider that white men are overrepresented on pretty much every police department in the country, and we know that white men are the group most likely to hold white supremacist viewpoints, I think it's very safe to say that this is a problem of America and a problem in policing, right? So it's, I think, easy to extrapolate from those numbers that there's a potential that about 10% of police officers or more hold these extremist views. And if that's the case, again, because police are public servants who are supposed to protect everyone, and we give them a tremendous amount of power and force, this is a very big problem, whether or not police are more likely to hold these views or similarly likely to have these views as the rest of America because of the amount of power we give police.
Yeah, and I wonder if it might be even another factor. I'm curious what you think about this. Another factor that might mean that the prevalence of these views among police is higher than among the background population, or even among the background population controlling for geogender and racial background, which is that both the sort of psychological profile of a police officer, which is, you know, again, one can think of it perhaps as a sort of an enforcement profile, which again, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. We need people to enforce norms. But if you combine that, then also with the sorts of policing that is done, and, you know, there's obviously debate about the extent of which, but I think no one can deny that policing is a form of social control, and there are obviously racial disparities baked into this system at some level, right? Putting aside the details, you end up with people that are both selected to perhaps hold certain extremist and supremacist views, and then through the process of that are exposed to scenarios which then reinforce the views that they already have, therefore making the problem worse. Right? Again, we might not know what the number is, but you know, if 10% is the floor, it seems very unlikely that it's the ceiling.
I think that's absolutely right. And as you say, you know, the ability to control others, the legal use of deadly force, the ability to openly carry weapons, the specialized training and access to information that law enforcement possess, those are all going to be attractive to people who hold white supremacist views because they want to subjugate people of color, and those drawn towards authoritarianism. So you've got this sort of perfect storm where, you know, these groups overlap sometimes, but not all the time. I mean, my previous research, I wrote in 2019 an article called KKK and the PD, where I explored explicit racial bias in police departments. And sort of through that research, I was constantly discarding other extremist viewpoints because, you know, I'm writing an article about one specific thing, but, you know, I kept coming across, you know, stories about, you know, groups like the Proud Boys who, you know, they certainly hold some white supremacist views, but their central tenet is more like misogyny, for example, or, you know, these militia groups like Oath Keepers and Three Percenters who are, you know, anti-government groups that are largely staffed by former police and former military. You see a lot of overlap in that sort of mindset, the sort of white supremacy and, you know, the authoritarianism. So you just, there's, you know, obviously there's a ton of overlap between fascism and racism.
The last factor you mentioned in your Lawfare piece, and I think here you're kind of appropriately circumspect about it because we're still figuring out the facts. And this way might be the most sort of explosive set of allegations of Capitol Police actually engaging and actually directly facilitating the January 6th attacks. And so what do we know right now? Obviously there are investigations going on. What can we say so far about this, you know, particularly serious situation?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, again, something that worries the people in the Capitol Police. So we know that there was an absolute absence of leadership on January 6th. Then Capitol Police Chief Sund never communicated with any of the officers that day. He never came over the radio, and he resigned promptly after January 6th. It's not clear to me whether he resigned on his own or whether he was asked to resign. We also know that there are dozens of Capitol Police that are under investigation. Six were suspended. Unfortunately, the Capitol Police is a uniquely opaque police department. Most police departments are pretty hard to get information out of, but Capitol Police actually cannot be subject to FOIA. And so there's even less information about Capitol Police than other police departments. But we do know that one officer has been indicted federally for some alleged obstruction of justice and advice he gave to someone on social media about how to sort of downplay his role on January 6th. And that officer allegedly said that he was politically sympathetic to the plight of the protesters. So I think we know that there were at least some Capitol Police who were sympathetic with the rioters. We saw, I think there's at least three officers who were investigated for taking selfies with rioters. There's some video that seems to suggest that the police allowed protesters behind barriers to gain entry to the Capitol, whether they did that because they were so exhausted and overwhelmed, or did they do that to actually aid protesters? You know, I think only they know. But I think for all the reasons we talked about earlier, it's not hard to imagine that at least some of Capitol Police were more sympathetic to the people who were trying to gain entry into the Capitol, to those inside doing their jobs.
So we have a problem, and hopefully we can do something about it. You don't address this part in the Lawfare piece, but you spend a good chunk of the underlying Law Review article talking about various reforms, and they're pretty wide ranging. And so I'm curious if you could sort of talk through, maybe not all of them, but just what you think sort of the top one or two or three reforms we could make to prevent this repeat, right? Either kind of specifically riots at federal government buildings, or more generally this problem of extremist sympathies in police departments, especially on the extreme right.
Sure. But before we do that, I just want to point out that I think there's the fourth issue that I raised in the piece that maybe we didn't get to, which is that police have underestimated the far right for years. And I know I've touched on it earlier, but I just want to mention that there's all those like sort of recent warnings that I'd mentioned before about what was going on in 2020 with militia groups showing up in support of Trump. But, you know, that's not the only sort of far-right extremism that police had to operate from and should have made them more alert on January 6th. There was the Unite the Right rally in 2017 in Charlottesville that I talked about previously. But there were also these mass shootings that were happening in 2018 and 2019. There was that shooting in El Paso the person who is alleged to have done that was motivated by anti-immigrant sentiment, and was a pro-Trump person and killed a number of people. There were those anti-Semitic shootings at synagogues. I think one in Pittsburgh. There was also one in San Diego in a suburb there. And, you know, there's just also a history of far-right extremism. There was a standoff in Oregon, anti-government movement. So police should have seen a threat from the far right. And we know that domestic terrorism is a bigger threat to the United States than terrorism from the outside of the United States. But yet that's not where law enforcement dollars and priorities have been allocated. It has been largely focused on threats from outside of the United States. And even the domestic terrorism budgets have been sort of disproportionately focused on groups like Antifa and Black Lives Matter. And so there has been just sort of this, you know, long-standing, years-long sort of ignoring of the threat of far-right extremism to the detriment of pretty much every minority group, right? We've got, you know, immigrants that are under attack. We have, remember the shooting at the Pulse nightclub. So we've got gay people under attack. We have, there was a shooting at a yoga studio by an involuntary celibate, a sort of a misogynist group. And we have violence against people of color. So we've got anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, homophobia. So we have all of these threats from the far right that are being ignored by law enforcement so that they can focus on threats by Muslims in the Muslim world and Black Lives Matter and Antifa in the United States. Like, it's just a mismatch of policing priorities and a real problem that makes us all less safe.
Yeah, and I imagine that a lot of the factors that we've spoken of throughout this conversation, questions of implicit bias, demographics, you know, all of those are in part, I suspect, they go toward this mismatch. So turning then to solutions, I imagine, you know, an obvious solution is, well, fix the mismatch, right? At the end of the day, policymakers could just decide this is no good, and we're going to rebalance. But I'm particularly curious in the internal reforms that could be made to police departments. Because again, if this is a intentional failure, that's very disturbing, but in a sense, that's kind of easy to solve. If it's an intentional failure, there's an intentional solution. But if the problem is a background set of cultural and demographic factors that cause even good faith police officers simply and good faith police leadership to just misunderstand the nature of the problem, that's a harder nut to crack. And so I'm very curious about what sort of internal reforms and changes you think would help move the needle in the short term or the long term.
Oh, great question. So I think you're absolutely right that this is a cultural problem in policing. And so a big sort of obvious answer to this problem is you got to fix the culture of policing, but, you know, easier said than done. So I think the first place to start is, for the reasons we talked about, we want police officers who care about threats to groups other than white men, right? So we need policing to be more diverse. We actually are right now in a moment where policing is becoming less diverse. So some of the diversity hiring that took place in the 1990s that led to there being more Black police officers, that's going away as those officers retire. And there are not a lot of young Black people who are lining up to become police officers right now because of the sort of loss of trust by police in Black and brown communities. So there's not going to continue to be a number of Black people in policing based on the sort of demographic shifts that are happening within policing. And sort of historically in policing, women have been very underrepresented. So those are big problems and they're really hard to fix because right now policing doesn't look attractive to people of color and to women for a number of reasons. If you just think, for example, about how police departments tend to recruit, right? Who they try to recruit and what those advertisements look like. They tend to be sort of going for the people that are more interested in the militaristic aspects of policing, you know, showing pictures of people in SWAT team uniforms and that kind of thing. But obviously, even just making sort of a concentrated effort to have a more diverse police force is not going to solve all the problems. But it is an important first step for the reasons we talked about before. White men are more likely to be politically conservative and are less likely, I think, to appreciate the threats of posed by other white people and certainly by other far-right extremists. And so having a more diverse police force will certainly help. And particularly having more women on police forces proven to reduce violence by police. And if there's less violence at the hands of police, you're actually more likely to recruit more people of color and more gay people to policing. So there's a lot of benefits that would flow from having a more diverse police force. But the biggest issue in my mind is we need to vet police better. You know, there need to be very serious social media checks before people get hired as part of background checks. You know, a lot of these warning signs are there. I often tell the story about a police officer in Little Rock, Arkansas, who was hired after admitting during his background check that he had gone to a KKK rally. And they were like, well, at least he was honest.
I'm assuming he didn't go as an anthropological research project.
No, he said that he went as a teenager. I think he said he wasn't sure whether he was 17 or 18. And they were like, well, he was honest. And they hired him anyway. Well, he went on to kill an unarmed Black child there. And this was information that only came out through the civil lawsuit. But I think that really points at the problem in the way we recruit police officers. This is often a career that people have for a very long time. And so making sure that the people we hire are people who don't hold extremist views in the first place is probably the most important thing we can do. And so doing better with background checks is hugely important. And I think police departments need to really think about hiring outsiders to do that, because right now it's just human nature to want to hire people that are like you, right? You relate to them, you know someone who knows that person. And so you're willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. That's how our minds work, right? We have these cognitive biases that keep us from being able to see things that might be apparent to other people. And so I think if you have people who aren't in policing making these hiring decisions, you're more likely to get better quality police in the first place. I think another really important step is we have to monitor people after they become police. We know that people can become more politically conservative as they age. If you think about who gets hired as a police officer, they tend to be people in their early 20s, and sometimes in some places, even in their late teens. But we know people may be police officers for 20 some odd years. And so the person you are politically in your early 20s is pretty different than who you might be in your 40s. And so being able to monitor people periodically during their tenure as police department in a police department is really important to make sure you don't miss someone who becomes, you know, more radical, more extreme in their politics or their viewpoints as they, you know, remain on the force and enjoy tenure on the force. And so I think that's a really important step that almost no police department is doing now. There should be sort of routine, periodic assessments of what's going on with the sort of ideologies of the police officers during their time on the force.
To close out, I want to zoom out a little bit and get your thoughts on how you're thinking about this particular issue has interacted with your sort of broader thinking about policing. Obviously, in a sense, the last 2 years about American, of the kind of public conversation, as it will, is about quote unquote defunding the police, pro or against, which is kind of a terrible way of framing the issue because it hides so many complexities and it's gotten very polarized. It does seem to me, and I'm curious what you think, if you'd agree or not, that listening to your set of reforms, all of which sound both important and doable to me, it kind of shows that neither that framing is not very helpful, right? Because on the one hand, just giving the police more resources is not going to be useful if those resources are used on more militarization, more hiring of the same problematic people, et cetera, et cetera.
And you have all of your equipment in a locked storage facility on the day that 10,000 people come to overthrow democracy. I mean, right? So you can have all the funding in the world, but if you don't deploy it and you can't assess risk, it's all kind of useless. Absolutely.
100%. On the other hand, as you pointed out, if we want policing to be a profession, or more professional, better, right? Better quality of people. We want to be able to screen out people with problematic backgrounds or whatever the case is. Defunding the police also seems very problematic, right? I mean, you need to pay for a high quality police force, and so I'm curious whether you think that ultimately the problem is, as it always is, just a more complicated one. It's we need a better police. And how to do that is the real trick that is hard to figure out.
I do think we spend generally too much money on policing for really diminished returns. I think January 6th and so much of Uvalde and so many things have shown us the police don't really do a good job of keeping everyone safe because of a number of issues involving misplaced police priorities, sort of a general punching down instead of punching up in terms of what police priorities are. There's just a lot of issues in policing that I'm not sure can be fixed. But I agree with you that it's not as simple as simply defunding police. That being said, I do think we need to absolutely right-size policing. And I think all of the issues that we have talked about today show us how vulnerable communities of color are. Right. When you think about the fact that there's a significant proportion of police that are sympathetic to far-right extremist views, we know that we are living in a place where these public servants don't work for everyone, and that's a real problem.
Well, I suspect this is not the last time we'll be talking about policing reform in the United States. Thank you so much. Thank you for the writing the post for Lawfare, for the excellent Law Review article that goes into a lot more detail on all these issues. So thanks so much for sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great fun.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, and our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th, the aftermath. Check out our written work on lawfareblog.com. You can also buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.